maybe you're old enough to remember shopping for long distance. And if so, you're probably old enough to remember this commercial from 1986.
Hello, Dallas.
Well, hi, Chicago.
Sounds a little crazy, but we wanted to see if the new fiber optic phone line in the system being built by U.S. Sprint really was so incredibly quiet that you could actually hear a pin drop.
You got it?
Loud and clear. That was a pin?
So call now, find out more, and save with U.S. Sprint, where every fiber...
So actually, here's what seems a little crazy. By the time Sprint, or U.S. Sprint, as it was known that time, aired that ad, the company was already nearly a century old. This is KCUR Central Standard, and today, at a time when the future of one of Kansas City's largest companies and biggest employers seems a little uncertain, we're looking back on the history of Sprint and how it came to be so important, when it all started with a guy stringing wire in Abilene. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman, and joining me to tell that story are a couple of guys who know a lot about the history of Sprint before it even was Sprint. Let me start with Michael Hook. He's joining us by phone from Abilene, where he's director of the Dickinson County Heritage Center. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Paint me a picture of the place where Sprint was born. What was Abilene, Kansas like in the late 1800s?
Yeah, we were basically just about a dozen log cabins for a while. Firstly established in 1857, and then for 10 years we were very quiet. And a guy was selling prairie dogs for $5 a pair, so that was our biggest merchant. And then Joseph McCoy showed up, who was the cattle king, and he brought in the Longhorns and worked around a quarantine zone and brought an amazing opportunity for Abilene, to which the chronology says that we probably wouldn't be the town we are today without McCoy. But to have the cowboys here was rough and tumble. It was a very dangerous place to be. And as people started coming over to go west, settling here, they realized that they couldn't coexist with the cowtown capital. So we pushed them out after 5 years. 1871 was the last good year for our cattle. And 72, it just started becoming very cosmopolitan. We started putting in fashion districts and started putting in bankers. And all these people that came to make a buck off the cowboys, in turn, were able to make a dollar off of big business and the industrialization. And this is just at the same time that Cleason Leroy Brown was born in 1872.
Cleason Leroy Brown, who becomes known as C.L. Brown, what does he do? How does he begin to enter into this world that will eventually turn into Sprint?
Yeah, he was born in Pennsylvania. He was the oldest of five, and his parents, Jacob and Mary Brown, were into the Church of the Brethren. And so they had a big population here in Dickinson County, and that's what brought the Browns here from Pennsylvania. And C.L. Brown was about 10 years old by the time he got here to Kansas. So he didn't get to see the wild and woolly days, but he did get to see the back end of what we really thought there was no end to our bounds. And we actually tried to steal the capital from Topeka. They try to become the Chicago of the Plains. These people were very forward-thinking for Abilene, for sure.
So C.L. Brown comes along. He grows up there, and he's working a job stringing electrical wire?
Yeah, he was doing all kinds of different jobs that he could. And then when he was a kid, he had both arms, the use of fully functional. Unfortunately, he got into a farming accident on his father's farm, got too close to a corn grinder, and it actually crushed his elbow, his right elbow. So his right arm had to be amputated. And at that time, as it is today, farming was a very physical job where you needed both your limbs for sure. And so that was the day that Brown realized that he was going to have to do things a little different. And that's, you know, kind of where he went from there. Going after Abilene High School, he went into teaching. He was teaching in a country school in Burlington, Iowa. Then he started attending business college. And it was probably, for that moment, it would have been an absolute disaster, but it actually was probably the best thing that ever happened to him.
And how did that end up working out? What turns him to what we today would call telecommunications, a word that certainly didn't exist then?
Yeah, he went to Wichita to run a creamery for a short time and then knew that he needed to come back home to Abilene. That's just where his heart was. And so in 1898, his father had a grist mill that was along the Smoky Hill River, just south of Abilene. And he was able to incorporate that grist mill and turn it into a power company, basically. It was generating electricity. And that helped power Abilene streetlights. It's been said that even before Brown, we actually had electric lights running downtown before New York City did. So that's kind of how we were forward thinking there. But we were keeping the lights on thanks to Brown. He was able to figure this out, spread all over Abilene and then to the neighboring areas. So his first business opportunity was into power. And you take a look at how the buyouts and all the company would survive. Eventually, it would open up for Westar that we know today, which is KCP&L and Kansas Power and Light. All that kind of been born here as well, not just Sprint.
So, Michael, don't go anywhere, but I want to bring into the conversation John Hoffman. He's here with us in the studio. He used to be a senior vice president at Sprint. He's written a little history of the place called That Was a Pin, which now makes sense after you hear that commercial we heard at the start of the show. And John, maybe it would help to understand what was happening with C.L. Brown to understand the rest of what was happening in telecommunications at the turn of the last century. What created the market for what C.L. Brown would go on to sell?
And Mike, that was fascinating. That was more than I knew about C.L. Brown. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
Alexander Graham Bell got the patent for telephone in 1876 and started the American Telephone Company, which became AT&T, and started building out telephone companies in mostly major cities across the United States. And did not pay attention, much attention, to smaller towns because there was not as much money to be made. Mm-hmm. So independent entrepreneurs started developing their own local telephone systems. And in Abilene, C.L. Brown had the poles for the transmission of transmission wires for electricity and added to those poles the wires necessary to provide telephone service.
So he starts out as basically the telephone company for Abilene.
Yes. And that was about 1899 and relatively quickly started doing business, acquiring other small independent telephone companies in other local communities, formally chartered the company, I believe in 1902, as United Utilities, because he had a water company, power companies, telephone companies, and it took off from there.
So he becomes quite an entrepreneur. He's a very successful business person.
Very much so.
Michael, I'm curious, this was all still headquartered in Abilene, right? What was the impact of this on the town?
Yeah, I think that was pretty special for us because at that time, 1886, when we had the Capitol going for us and we were trying to bring in Chicago, everything seemed like it was going great. And then there was a large depression that hit the country even in the 1880s, very similar to what we would know in the 1930s, and land holdings and everything kind of fell apart. So people gave up on Abilene. They all moved away. They left us. And we are so lucky that Brown entered the picture at that time. Otherwise, who knows what would have happened to Abilene. C.L. Brown is recognized as the man that saved the town, and we appreciate that. It would have been easy for him to go to Kansas City or Chicago at that point because he was establishing himself as a great businessman with the long-distance power reaching all the way to Kansas City at that time. But he kept all of his holdings and all of his businesses and personal ventures right here. One of my favorite things that he did for us was he opened Brown's Memorial Park, which was actually an amusement park and baseball fields. And he flooded the lake and turned it into a Waikiki beach with white sand and all these great things. There was a zoo out there as well. He never charged anyone to go there. He wanted to put everything back. He was so benevolent, put it all back in Abilene. Don't hold on to your money, spend it, and we really appreciate him. He built us the Sunflower Hotel. He built us all these great buildings and homes. His remnants are still here today. You can still see the C.L. Brown impact there.
John Hoffman, how big did the company get under Brown, under C.L. Brown? How far did it reach?
Well, it grew relatively steadily, mostly through acquisitions of other small local telephone companies. For a few decades, and it got so big that he started, C.L. Brown went out and recruited a gentleman by the name of Skip Scupine to become the president of the company to take it to its next level. And in the late 50s, early 60s is when Skip Scupine decided that he needed to move the headquarters to Kansas City in order to recruit more experienced executives.
And so before we move with this conversation to Kansas City and we say goodbye to Michael Hook, who is joining us from Abilene, before we let you go, Michael, I know you run the Heritage Center there for the county. You also, that includes the Museum of Independent Telephony.
Yeah.
What could a person see there if they are willing to make the trek out to Abilene?
Well, we do kind of follow the history like we've been talking today. We start with Alexander Graham Bell. We show the telegraphs just before that and how communication kind of proceeded to that point. And then it's kind of fun to think that telephones were laughed at the first World's Fair and nobody would ever want these in their homes. And now it's, telephones probably has become the greatest invention in American history. So we appreciate showing that off from the chronology. And we have models of just about every phone from circa 1885 on to, of course, the phones of Mickey Mouse and Kermit the Frog that you'd have in the 80s. So we tell the story through and through with the switchboards and the operators and the party lines and all that. What I really appreciate is that the kids that come through in school groups have no concept of even a rotary phone. So we get to tell this whole story of how it all ended up fitting in your pocket.
It's like magic.
Yeah.
Michael Hook is the director of the Dickinson County Heritage Center. He's been joining us by phone from Abilene, talking about the history of C.L. Brown and the founding of what would go on to become Sprint. Michael, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're continuing this conversation with John Hoffman, who wrote a little history of Sprint and joins us today. We're glad to take your questions, too. If you have questions or memories of Sprint, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. John Hoffman, you mentioned that the United Telephone Company, as it came to be called, left Abilene so it could recruit the kinds of people you can only recruit by being in a city. They came to Kansas City. What was the environment for them here?
First, let me just real quickly mention the Independent Telephone Museum that Michael mentioned. It's a fascinating place for anybody to go to. In fact, in my younger days, I used to collect antique telephones and donated a lot of them to that museum. It's a great place. When Skip Scupine first brought the company to Kansas City, they were officed in the VFW building on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And Skip went about trying to recruit excellent people to improve the company. And one of his first and probably his best recruit was a gentleman by the name of Paul Henson, who grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and went to the University of Nebraska. And after serving as a fighter pilot in the Air Force, was working for Lincoln Telephone and Telegraph. And Skip brought him to Kansas City. This was, I believe, 1960, to be vice president of operations. And obviously, he eventually became president and chairman of the board and really took the company to the next level after Skip retired.
And remind us what the company was. It's so hard to imagine what a telephone company even did if it wasn't AT&T or Ma Bell back then.
Well, that's when they came to Kansas City, it was still United Utilities because it was a combination of water and electric and telephone companies. And one of the things Paul did was sold off the water and the electric companies and became exclusively a telephone company, the United Telephone System. And he initiated what was known as a growth through additions program where he started acquiring other independent telephone companies across the United States. And in his first 4 years, he doubled the size of the company. And the next 4 years, he doubled the size again.
Wow.
So it grew relatively rapidly in the 60s.
And did it matter what telephone company your town had at that point? Would you notice differences in how they provided service?
Hopefully, when United Telephone acquired them, you noticed an improvement in service.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this was also the time when the telephone industry was converting from all operator-handled calls to dial telephones. interestingly for Kansas City, the dial telephone was invented here. It was invented by owner of a mortuary by the name of Strowinger. And the reason he invented it is because the girlfriend of one of his competitors was a telephone operator. And when she would get a call for a mortuary, she would always route the call to his competitor and not to him. So he wanted to eliminate the possibility of the operators interfering with his business, and he invented the dial, the Strowinger switch, which became relatively prevalent in the industry over a short period of time.
No kidding. So Kansas City, as we're hearing today in a variety of ways, is at the heart of a lot of emerging technologies.
Absolutely.
When did you start working with the company, John?
Oh, my goodness. I graduated from law school here at UMKC in 1967. And that summer, Paul Henson hired me as a summer intern, working for the company, and I was sharpening pencils and moving desks.
So it's 50 years ago, 51 years ago. How big was the company at that point? How many employees would you guess it had?
Oh, I'm sure it was less than 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
And we were getting near the end of the growth through additions program, and you had to count all the employees. And at that time, we were in, my goodness, I think it was 30, 32 states. So we were rather widespread. In fact, at that point, when I started there, is when Paul went on this program to kind of assimilate all of the acquisitions into the United Telephone family and started moving people around, moving people from the acquired companies into headquarters and people in the headquarters out to the operating companies. Just to get everybody kind of cross-trained and familiar with one another. In fact, that in 1975, they moved me to the company in Tennessee, and I was there for 5 years.
So even though we now think of Sprint as this global company, it was global in that day. People were moved back and forth and all over the place. It had that kind of reach even 50 years ago.
On a much smaller scale, but
yes.
But that's the same approach, absolutely.
So the company expands. You're there through the 70s, but the world is changing too. The commercial that we heard earlier from the 1980s speaks to what Sprint had moved into by then. They were selling long-distance service, and the selling point was the quality of their sound. What was that all about?
It's interesting. The courts opened up the long-distance market. Prior to 1974, it was an absolute monopoly for AT&T. AT&T called it long lines for long-distance service. And in 1974, as a result of a case brought by MCI, the courts opened up that market to competition. So people started entering the market primarily because it was so expensive, so capital-intensive to try to compete with AT&T by building lines. They were using microwave, which was a service that became popular during World War II. And microwave service was cheaper for customers than AT&T long lines, but the service was spotty.
Mm-hmm.
Weather could affect it, distance could affect it. When we decided to get into the long-distance business in the early 80s, we chose – initially, we acquired companies that had microwave service but decided we were going to build a nationwide fiber optic network. And at that time, a lot of people thought we were crazy because it was so expensive, but it provided a much higher quality service over a longer period of time or a longer distance, and it was.
And now this is how everybody does this now, right? That's how phone service is provided at this point.
Yeah, it's to me it's interesting that when we were building the network and we built 26,000 miles of cable across the United States, AT&T took great pleasure in mocking us. Saying that we were way out of line, we were doing something that was not necessary, that they had enough copper cable to serve all of the telecommunications needs of everybody forever. And about 6 years later, they ended up having to write off the investment of all of their copper cable and turn around and instead started building fiber in order to compete with us because the quality was so good. And it was, I'm probably getting into the weeds too much, but with fiber optic cable, it's a digital service. With yeah. copper, it's an analog service. And that's one of the ways moving from analog to digital, you eliminate all of the background noise. And
right. And you also pave the way for what would be an even more transformative change to moving to wireless. We have a call actually at 816-235-2888 from Marianne, a longtime Sprint customer. Hello, Marianne.
Hi, good morning. I have been a longtime Sprint customer. I had a bag phone, and the person who answered the phone when I called had no idea what a bag phone is.
Yes, you. I don't either. You have to tell me what a bag phone is.
It was a receiver that was in a telephone that the whole unit plugged, I think, into my cigarette lighter, and I got it because I was traveling around all over the state in a car, and sometimes I would have the car would break down or I'd get a flat tire. I could use the receiver in my bag phone to call somebody. It was a safety measure for me, and because Sprint was the only one I knew of who had these things, I have remained a Sprint customer from then until today.
Wow, the bag phone. Is that an innovation you can claim any credit for, John?
Well, probably the only credit I can claim is that I still have my bag phone. That was back in the days before the current cellular service, which is called PCS or Personal Communication Services. And cellular at that time required a great deal of power to send the signal from the instrument to the tower. And the only power, enough power that was available to do that was your car battery. That's why the early cell phones all were attached to automobiles, either directly or like Mary said, through the cigarette lighter.
Wow. Well, Marianne, thank you so much for the call.
You're welcome. I wish I still had my original one. It would be a real treasure today.
It would be. Well, maybe they'll have one at the Museum of Independent Telephony we can hear about in we've heard about in Abilene.
I'll probably donate mine there.
Well, there you go. You know, we're almost out of time, and we could talk about this for a long time, John, but, you know, you left the company in 2000, I understand.
Right.
It's been a little while, and the company has continued to grow and change a great deal, moved the headquarters to Overland Park since then. As you hear about the proposed changes now, the possible merger, T-Mobile's headquarters, of course, is not in Kansas City, and it might be that the headquarters isn't here anymore. How does that affect you? How do you think about all that?
Well, I'm troubled by it. In 2000, when I left, there were very secret negotiations going on with WorldCom about WorldCom acquiring the company.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of the very few that did not think that was a very good idea, you know, which was one of the reasons I thought it was time to spend more time with my family than with the company. Excuse me. I was convinced at that time that WorldCom was going to close down the headquarters. And in fact, we were just building the headquarters at that time when I retired. And I think we're facing the same kind of a thing now with T-Mobile. I think it's facing considerable regulatory challenges, both from the Department of Justice and the FCC. I think it's going to face problems with employees, like we did back in 2000. And I think it's going to cause a problem for stockholders because there's just not the kind of premium that T-Mobile is willing to pay.
Well, it's really interesting to dig a little bit into this history, and I appreciate your help doing it. John Hoffman was Senior Vice President of External Affairs at Sprint before he retired, and he's written a book called That Was a Pin. John, thank you so much.
Glad to do it.
When we come back, we reach a bit further back in our area's history. Okay, a lot further back, to the very first group of people who lived here. With local scholars' help, we'll go there too. KCUR Central Standard is back in a minute. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. Whether learning about Lewis and Clark in our classrooms, or seeing popular representations of American Indians in books and movies, or even from taking our own travels to the pueblos of the Southwest or the reservations of the Pacific Northwest or ancient ruins in Mexico, most of us know that the indigenous peoples of the Americas represented a vast array of nations and tribes and cultures as diverse as the terrain they covered from Alaska to Argentina. So the conclusions of a recent scientific paper may be surprising to many of us, that the founding population of the Americas, the ones who first came across from Siberia, may have numbered just around 250 people. That research was done by a group that stretched, maybe a little like the migration pattern itself, from Seattle to Brazil, with a stop in Lawrence. And that's where Michael Crawford was part of the team. He's an anthropology professor at KU, and he joins us from there this morning. Dr. Crawford, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here. So before we get into the details of this research, I'm curious why you were interested in it. How did figuring out the makeup of early American populations become of interest to you?
I'm fascinated by migration, human migration. Since I'm an immigrant myself, I came to this country as a teenager, and I'm interested in what are the causes of migration? Why do people migrate? And secondly, what are the biological evolutionary consequences of migration over time? And if you think about people moving out of Africa originally, about 130,000 years ago, they reached Asia about 30,000 years ago, and then to the Americas around 23,000 years ago. So if you think about a small group of people migrating from Alaska, the Beringian landmass, all the way to Tierra del Fuego in Argentina in 15,000 years, it's a fantastically interesting experiment, if you wish, quotes around experiment.
From the
standpoint of moving into very different environments, different conditions, different selective factors operating on the populations and so forth. And that's why I got fascinated by this question.
It is fascinating. And you mentioned Beringia, which is we might recognize Bering, like the Bering Straits.
Bering, right.
So
right.
This
the land bridge.
The land bridge. And that happened 23,000 years ago, you say. How do you get from there to here? How quickly is that migration happening then?
Well, about 23,000 years ago, how do we know that there are archaeological sites in Alaska, right on the Alaska-Canadian border, that date back to 23,000 years? But the movement didn't start until about 15,000 years ago, as the two glaciers started to provide a passageway between them, and people also moved along the coast. So we know this mainly from archaeological evidence, as well as some of the DNA evidence now that I can talk about.
So they hung out up there for about
8,000 years. We think, you know, it's known as the Beringian standstill model, that they hung around Siberia, parts of northeastern Siberia, and Alaska, all the way to, say, a little past the Canadian border.
And these don't seem like very favorable places to live, especially without modern heating and cooling.
Actually, the conditions were fairly decent in those days, judging from some of the excavations that have been done, suggesting that, in fact, the conditions were much better in the Beringian landmass than in parts of Siberia, for example. It was actually a nice grassland country.
How nice.
Right. It was an oasis, a landmass with grasslands, a lot of fauna, a lot of flora of different sorts that humans could utilize.
So I guess the question is then, why did the migration happen at all? Why did they come further south into the Americas?
Well, humans tend, particularly hunting and gathering groups like these were, they tend to live in groups of about 50 to 70 individuals, and that's the most efficient way to be able to hunt, gather food, etc. When the population gets a little larger than that, these groups, these hunting and gathering groups, split, undergo fission, and one part of the group moves to the next county. Okay. And so this continues over time, as each population, gets, the fertility gets larger, the population increases, they undergo fission. You know, there used to be some theories about somehow there was some sort of inherent drive to move. You know, come on, Ivan, let's go. You know, let's go to the next county or whatever.
Yeah.
That's unlikely. The most likely explanation is that the population dynamics were such that the groups of about 50 to 75 were the most efficient way to handle food procurement and et cetera.
And then pretty soon resources would be too scarce in that small an area. They needed to spread out.
And they would move on. And, you know, for example, in the Aleutian Islands where I worked, it's very clear people would come to one island. They would pretty well pick out, kill off all the easy prey, and then it moved to the next island. And so it was a continuous movement.
Now, this part is all pretty well established, but you've done research that, along with others, that shows that the number of people who were in this original group to migrate into the Americas mm-hmm. was 250, which, or so.
Or so. The thing is, this was done by getting DNA from volunteers in China, in Siberia, about 10 populations in Siberia, about 10 populations in the Americas from volunteers who were interested in collaborating with us. And that was the basis for estimating then the population size using a migration model and computer simulation over millions of generations to go back and estimate the size. And so the size varies from about 200 to about 400 people, with the median estimate from all these computer runs being about 250.
And that just seems like a strikingly small number of people to trace back the origins of what would become, what, millions of people by the time...
at least 40 million, yeah, at contact times, yeah. Well, again, when you think about it, the estimates were based on how much diversity there was in the different populations in Siberia, in the Americas, and how many mutations occurred. So it was the diversity, genetic diversity, divided basically by the mutations, give you an estimate of what's known as the effective breeding size of the population and the effective sizes, all those in the population who contributed genetically to the next generation.
Say more about how this research came to be. You have not just been sitting in a lab analyzing numbers to do this.
Well, it started, well, my first work was in Alaska in 1977, St. Lawrence Island, Wales, Alaska, and I also had an NSF grant to compare them to Siberian populations. But during the Cold War, it was not possible to be able to access the native Siberian peoples. Hmm. But however, in 1989, the Soviet Union sort of started to fall apart, to break up.
Yes.
And this allowed us to go in. We were the first, my group was the first to come into Siberia and were permitted to sample the Siberian populations.
By that you mean you took blood samples?
In those days we took blood samples from the Siberian populations, and this is working with the Soviet Academy of Sciences in those days. And so we were able to look at least 10 different populations from different parts of Siberia and then compare them to other groups. So it started around 1976. 1989, things opened up and we were able to get DNA, blood, and then DNA from these populations.
And meanwhile, on the other end of that migration, you managed to make contact with various groups in Central and South America, too.
Right. But this was mainly my Brazilian colleagues and the Brazilian colleagues, Francisco Salzano, and for one, who very distinguished researcher from Porto Alegre in Brazil, He had been working with the various native populations of Brazil, Venezuela, and all the way up to Central America. So he was able to obtain the DNA from the South American, Central American groups. I obtained DNA from the Siberian populations and some of the Chinese populations. Mm-hmm. And we were able to sort of retrace the migration in terms of the different contemporary populations and use them and their genomes to reconstruct their diversity, mutation rates, etc., and then using computer simulation estimate then the size of the founding groups.
And you do that, and I obviously am not a genetics expert myself, but you do that by laying aside, laying together the DNA of the genome of a Siberian native, let's say, alongside an Alaskan Aleut or alongside a Brazilian tribe member, and you somehow can tell how many generations have passed between them? Is that what's happening?
Sort of. What we do is we've looked at nine particular regions of the genome, okay? Nine different regions were sequenced for the Siberians, the Native Americans, and also the Chinese, and then computed from that the observed diversity, and then calculated how many mutations occurred since they moved from Siberia to the Americas, and then used a computer simulation of isolation with migration model to try to estimate the different sizes that would be required to see the diversity that we have now.
250 people in this original group doesn't seem like a lot. It seems like today, if we thought an entire population had to develop out of a group the size of 250, we would be worried about, inbreeding or of that would seem like too small a pool. Does that help me understand that in context of what we think of today as a small population?
Now, again, this is the effective size of the population of the founding. In other words, those who actually contributed to the, you know, the subsequent generations. The population may have been larger, but only 250 of them, or around 250, with an estimate of 250, actually contributed genes to the subsequent generations. Now, in terms of inbreeding, yes, it's possible there was some inbreeding, but the effects of inbreeding really do not affect the survivorship of the group.
Hmm. Now, why does this research matter? I mean, it is fascinating, but how does the knowledge you gain from this kind of study improve people's lives today?
Well, from the standpoint of if we know, it's understanding the evolutionary consequences of migration, which is the most, you know, if you think of this study, you have to think in terms of where did Native Americans come from? Okay.
Yeah.
When? The number of migrations, how do they come, and then this is the last part, the actual size of the founding population. What this tells us is, you know, with the fantastic migrations that are going on from Iraq or from parts of the Middle East to Europe, from Europe to the U.S., what are the consequences of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the consequences are genetic, disease, probably these would be the primary ones in terms of, you know, who migrates, how does it affect society, how does it affect the disease patterns that you see.
So, for example, when we think about the impact of white Europeans coming to North America and the impact that that had on native populations in terms of the vulnerability those populations had to disease. Is that a result of this small founding group?
Absolutely. Well, it's they had less variation than, say, the European populations. They did not have a history of certain group-specific diseases that you found in Europe. And so they were much more at risk for these density, you know, crowd diseases such as, you know, tuberculosis, smallpox, things of that sort.
Sure. Does anything surprise you about these findings?
Does it surprise me? Not really. If you use mitochondrial DNA, the maternal part of the genome, which measures the female contribution to the founders, the population size is much smaller. So from the standpoint, the founding population. So I think the important point is trying to understand how people migrate, how they adapt genetically to the specific environments that they come to.
That's Michael Crawford. He's an anthropology professor at the University of Kansas. He joined us from there this morning. Dr. Crawford, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll talk more about science and history. Before we knew about genetic fingerprints, we had fingerprints. We identify the Kansas City area's part in that technology when KCUR Central Standard continues. Stick around. It's KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. And now back to the future, and another story about technology pioneered here in the Kansas City area. Fingerprinting has been around since the age of the ancient Egyptians, but modern criminal forensics here in the U.S. have only been using fingerprints to identify criminals for a little over 100 years. And where do you think that technique was developed? Yep, here in Kansas City. Our friend Patrick Quick went looking for that story.
My quest for the origins of fingerprinting began after hearing about an infamous case of mistaken identity that took place in Leavenworth Federal Prison at the turn of the century. To assist me on my historical journey, I enlisted the help of these men.
Kenneth M. LeMaster, I'm an author, historian, retired from the United States Penitentiary, Leavenworth, Kansas, in 2010. I always tell people I can give them the most mundane information about a federal prison they ever want to know.
Stephen Spence, archive specialist, National Archives of Kansas City.
This curious case of mistaken identity begins in 1903 when a new inmate named Will West arrives at Leavenworth Penitentiary. Only something seems odd about this man's presence.
One afternoon, they bring this man into process, and the records clerk, being an astute individual, looks at Will West and he kind of just gets the idea that he's seen him before, he knows who he is.
They did mug shots, the measurements, everything that you had to do in a prison intake. And he took one look at Will West and said,
"Have you ever been here before?"
"No, sir. I've never been to prison before. I've never been to this prison before."
He started digging around and he says, "Well, don't we have some more files on you?" And he starts looking. Well, he finds this file on William West.
Sure enough, found an inmate from 1901 named William West who was a match. He was like, "See, you have been here before."
He says, "You're telling me that you're not this guy right here?" "No, I'm not that guy right there." Well, they get back into the institution and discover that
the William West from the 1901 file was still in prison.
They have two guys with virtually the same name, virtually the same Bertillon measurements, the same look, same build, same height. And, well, we've got two individuals here that are almost identical.
Looking at their photographs and looking at the Bertillon measurements they used, they could not differentiate.
That term, Bertillon? I'll explain that a little later.
All of a sudden, you're just looking at somebody that looks vaguely familiar, and it's not you.
So they tried an experiment. They took both men's fingerprints. They looked at their photographs, looked at their Bertillon measurements, and the only way they could differentiate between the two was through fingerprinting.
Prior to this incident at Leavenworth Prison, fingerprinting had never been used to ID criminals here in the U.S.
In the early years of the prison, they wanted to have a uniform way to identify criminals. And at the time, there was a system in place. It was created in 1879. It was called Bertillon measurements.
It was based on rudimentary measurements of parts of people's anatomy. The circumference of your head, the measurement of the bridge of your nose to your forehead,
the length of your ears, the length of your trunk,
your jaw pattern, the length of your arm from your elbow to your forefinger,
eye color, hair color, all these things.
And all of these were calibrations done using pretty much basically the same tools that a furniture manufacturer would use.
Forensic scientists would then take those measurements and document them with the corresponding criminal.
And the idea behind it was, one, they could track the criminal population, and two, they would, through data collection, come up with a criminal standard. They would know a criminal by looking at them because they have the right physical characteristics.
Theoretically, they'd be able to size up a shady character just by taking his measurements. Bertillon measurements were based in pseudoscience and tended to follow other pseudoscientific trends at the time, such as phrenology and eugenics.
It was a pretty reliable system, but there were people that had very, very similar Bertillon measurements, and then all of a sudden you get these two guys that look pretty darn close to being the same person, and it just starts kind of clicking that maybe there's a better system we could evolve into or a better way to identify these guys.
By measuring and documenting their fingerprints, prison officials could now physically prove that the two Will Wests were two separate people. However, these two inmates look so much alike that, even today, it's still not entirely clear if these two were siblings, identical twins, or if they just happened to look strikingly similar to one another. In fact, our historians Ken and Steve still differ on this.
I've never found any type of relationship that can definitely prove. I mean, I've read articles that, oh, they were brothers, or they were twin brothers, or they were distant cousins or something. I've never been able to make a definite connection that either one of them were related to each other.
Steve thinks otherwise.
I guess the brothers weren't forthcoming at first about being identical twins. You know, maybe they were not trying to shame the family any more than you can be with having two brothers in the same prison. But they discovered, I guess, through going through their correspondence that these letters were going to the same place. And that so they used some, I don't know, social engineering to figure out they were brothers.
Related or not, Will and William West looked identical. And the only way that prison officials were able to tell the difference between them was by using their fingerprints.
Through this happy accident of these, I don't know if you want to call it happy accident, through this accident of these two identical twins making it to Leavenworth, fingerprinting became the established way to track criminals.
Since then, forensic technologies have evolved over the years and can now identify individuals using DNA, retina scans, or even voice recognition software. Yet fingerprinting continues to be the standard in many cases because of how accurate it is.
It's my understanding there is a 1 in 64 billion chance for two people's fingerprints to be alike. If it wasn't effective and reliable, it would have been replaced by something by now. Technologies don't last for over a century unless they're really, really good.
In fact, fingerprinting became so good that some criminals even attempted to beat the system. Just look at the case of one of Chicago's most infamous gangsters from the 1930s.
John Dillinger used acid to take his fingerprints off.
That was a common thing back in that era. They would burn their fingers, they would cut their fingers, they would shave off their fingerprints. I mean, it really wasn't an uncommon thing, and it was employed by a lot of particularly your mid-20s, early 30s gangsters to avoid detection.
Lots of people try to do it. I don't know how effective that is.
The story of the two Will Wests demonstrated the true value of documenting a criminal's fingerprint.
Back then, it may take a guy 6, 7, 8 hours to positively identify an individual using his fingerprints, where today it's as simple as in a booking room of a local jail, them taking their thumb and sticking it on a pad that's attached to a national crime computer, and within seconds, their entire criminal history pops up on a screen in front of them.
Today, biometrics such as retina scans continue to evolve and adapt to our everyday lives, but fingerprints will continue to be the standard for years to come because of their simplicity and overall accuracy.
You kind of take for granted today what you have and never ever think about, hey, you know, I can take my thumb and stick it on my cell phone and it knows who I am. Where did that all get started?
That story first aired in 2015 and was produced by Patrick Quick. Well, our time is up for today's show, but you can listen back to any of our episodes at kcur.org/centralstandard. Check back this afternoon to hear those segments on the history of Sprint or on the 250 people who first populated the Americas. kcur.org/centralstandard. And if you missed yesterday's discussion on t-shirts throughout history, well, that's online there too. Join us tomorrow for a portrait session with Kansas City writer and director and producer David Wayne Reed. Our show is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Coy Duggar. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay tuned now for Up to Date, which is coming up next.